I sure hope you're hungry.
Ooh, I'm starving.
Wash those hands, pull up a chair, and secure that feed bag. Because it's time to listen to Scott Tolinsky and Wes Boss attempt to use human language to converse with and pick the brains of other developers. I thought there was going to be food. So buckle up and grab that o-shit handle, because this ride is going to get wild. This is the Syntax Supper Club.
Welcome to Syntax. This is the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. I was wrong about what resumability was. We talked about it, I don't know, like a month or two ago, and we are going through all the like different kinds of like hydration and server side and whatnot, and we got to the resumability one, and Scott was trying to explain it to me, but I just wasn't grokking it. So I thought like, why don't we have the creator of Quick on, which is one of the frameworks in the space right now that is sort of championing this thing, which is resumability. So if you are like a React developer or something like that, you're going to want to listen to this one because it's super interesting. So Mishko Hevri, that's right. That's how you pronounce your name?
You got it on the first try, man. Very impressed.
Nice.
Awesome. So among other things, creator of Angular, AngularJS, and now working on this sort of new approach, new mindset to building applications, both server and client side. So excited. Welcome. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
So I watched a little bit of the YouTube video. I went through the documentation enough to get like a good idea, but like not too much because I still want to ask some really good questions. So do you want to give us a quick rundown or do you want to give us a quick
rundown? I can. I'm almost curious, like, what do you think resumability is? Like, I want to hear your side of the story and then I see to kind of better understand like where the message isn't getting through. So what do you think it is?
After going through the docs and whatnot, I think it downloads the HTML and then only downloads the JavaScript to run that part of the application, whether it's a counter or a shopping cart or something like that, when it's needed. So it's sort of on-demand loading both of the JavaScript, but as well as it looks like you can do state. And I saw this amazing example where you literally just copied the HTML, pasted it into another tab, and the thing just resumed.
Yeah.
how close am I?
No, that's actually pretty close. I would actually say that's dead on. I think the trouble is that people say like, well, that sounds reasonable. Why can't my framework do that, right? And so the interesting bits are more about like why other frameworks can't do this. Like what is it about them, right? And then once you understand that, resumability is kind of like one of these things like, of course, obvious. Like why would you do it any other way? So it's more like that.
Okay.
So we can hop into it if you'd like.
Yeah. Tell us about it.
So the best way I found to kind of explain it is, do you remember when virtual machines first came onto scene? And one of the things you could do in the virtual machine is like, let's say you're in your host machine, let's say you're in Windows, right? And you boot up a Linux and you literally watch in the window as Linux is booting up. So you see BIOS comes up and then the boot up sequence happens and then the login screen shows up and then you type in your username and password and you log in. And then, you know, open up, spreadsheet or something and, you know, start typing your expenses, right? And at any point, you can hit the pause button and the virtual machine saves the full state of everything into the disk, into a file. And the thing that blew my mind when I first saw this is that you can take this file and move it to a different physical machine, different host machine, right? Mm-hmm. And open it. And the machine is literally where it was, like where you just left over, like it just resumed, right? What you didn't see the second time you did this is you didn't see the boot up sequence. You didn't see the BIOS come up. You didn't see the login screen. You don't have to log in. Like you literally, it came up and your spreadsheet was open with the cursor blinking at the next thing you could type in.
Yeah. And you could duplicate that and send it to a friend. That's how the IE machine did as well.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So the power of that was like, oh, great. I can just like make 50 copies of this thing or 1,000, 100,000 copies of these things and send it to all my friends. And they literally just resume where you left off.
Okay.
Yeah, no. I guess for the listeners who aren't familiar with Quick at all, maybe it'd be good to give a high level, like, Quick as a thing is a JavaScript framework to do user interfaces. Is that accurate?
So the best way to kind of describe it is like what other things are, right? So if you have mostly React developers, so Quick is just like React. Mm-hmm. And Quick City is like, let's say, Next.js or Remix, right? So basically the full stack development that people are used to, that they do today in the React ecosystem, we have kind of the equivalent of these things in the Quick ecosystem. You know, if you go to Vue, there is Vue and Nuxt. If you go to Solid, there is Solid and Solid Start. If you go to SvelteKit, mm-hmm. there is SvelteKit and Svelte and SvelteKit, right? And so all of these ecosystems basically have the same parts. So Quick and Quick City are the two parts that together allow you to build anything you could build on Next.js. And it's literally equivalent. Like, my point of view is that whatever you can build with React or Angular or any of the other favorite frameworks of yours that you happen to have, you should be also be able to build in Quick. So in terms of capabilities, it's in the same category.
Yeah, like, I got the feeling that you'd be able to, like, scan the docs in half a day, go through the tutorials, and you'd be up and running pretty quickly, because, like, the big thing is it's JSX, right? Like, you're using the same templating language that React is using, right?
It's JSX, it's hooks, you know, especially for a React developer. If you come to Quick, you look at this stuff and you go, like, this is very familiar, and you should be up and running very quickly. And it's kind of intentional. This is not, one of the things is, when we were doing this, we wanted to bring something new to the table, and the new thing to the table is resumability. And so we didn't want to reinvent the wheel on everything else. And so we were like, what off-the-shelf components can we grab to make this thing, you know, do its thing so that we don't have to get distracted, and we can just focus on the value add, and the value add is resumability.
Okay. Can you give us, like, maybe a couple examples of components that you might want to make resumable, and like, why you would even want to do that?
Yeah. So the interesting part about Quick is that as a developer, you don't really have to think about it. Like, that's kind of the value proposition here is that, you know, the easy thing, the obvious thing, the natural thing to do when you're building your application component or what have you, is also the performant thing to do. Like, the two are aligned. It's not like you have a choice to make. Like, I could do the easy thing, or I could do the performant thing, and I'm under time pressure, so I'm going to do the easy thing, right? Like, no, the two are the same. They're literally the same. And so as a developer, you don't really think about it or choose to make things resumable or not resumable. It's just the property of the system that automatically just happens for your whole application. So you just build your application as you would build any other thing. And then the application has these interesting properties, which is that, first of all, SEO out of the box. You didn't have to do anything, and just SEO out of the box, right? So it's SSR first. Another property you get is that, well, we don't send all the JavaScript over until it's needed. But now you also need to start doing prefetching, so to make sure if you're, like, in a tunnel or the connection is hiccupy or something like that, you perform well. So you get prefetching of the code out of the box. There's a service worker that does that, and that's very intelligent. Code splitting, bundling, making sure that you don't have overly large bundle sizes. So all of these optimizations that normally you have to do once your application gets big, they're just part of the how Quick works, and you don't even have to think about it. It's just there.
So is the pitch, you get to write things with a very similar API. It's not the same if you look at some of the docs, but, like, it's very similar.
A lot of stuff
API.
Is nicer.
A lot of stuff is nicer, right? So you get a very similar API, but you get a more performant experience without having to really adjust your frame of reference that much.
That's right. That's exactly it. And I think we can go down a kind of an example to kind of appreciate this. So let's say you decide your application is big and you need to do lazy loading. Right, I mean, application gets big and then it's too slow to load, and you talk to the experts, and the experts are like, "That's easy. Just break up your application in smaller chunks." Right?
Yeah.
So let's go down that rabbit hole
into just tooling hell.
The tooling hell that's required for this thing. So you say, well, the first thing you need to figure out is where exactly you're going to put a boundary, and this is not obvious. And let's say you find a component that you want to lazy load. So in React, you would move the component to a separate file so that you can create a separate chunk. Then you leave behind a lazy function call, right? Then you put a suspense around it. And now, in theory, this thing is lazy loadable, right? So then you start up your application and you realize, actually, bonkers, it isn't. Because that particular component is visible on initial render. And so the fact that you made it lazy loadable didn't actually help or anything. Because you see, the suspense or lazy loading of components is only useful for components that are not currently in the render tree, right? If the component is in the render tree, it's pointless to do lazy loading. Because like it has to be rendered. And so you actually just made the situation worse. Because now instead of getting a single bundle that's all, you know, inlined, now you actually got two bundles. And the way React does this is it renders everything up to the suspense boundary. Then it like gives up, waits for the thing to load, and then starts rendering again, you know, from where it left off. And so now it's doing twice as much work. And I mean, not exactly twice as much, but like it's more work than it would just do the whole thing directly. And then let's say that this works. Then you have another problem, which is like, great, but now I'm on a slow network and like this lazy loading really is bugging me because there's a delay. And so now I have to figure out like, how do I prefetch these things? And you think you could just add a prefetch tag to the HTML. Turns out that's broken. It kind of works in Chrome and everywhere else, it just doesn't work. Like it's just a hint that everybody else ignores, especially mobile devices. So that doesn't work. So then you have to have some other mechanism for fetching the code and deciding like when exactly should I fetch the code, right? If I fetch all the code eagerly at the beginning, that's kind of pointless because like that's the same thing as just loading everything. And so you have all of these problems that arise when you try to lazy load something and it's not obvious that you even can, right? So like we did a simple example of lazy loading component, but let's say the problem isn't that. Let's say the problem is that you have to lazy load a listener or only part of it, or, you know, there's like gazillion different ways you could do that. And then of course, if you go through all this trouble, you might not actually get the benefit you thought you had. You know, how do you measure this thing? Then how do you move these boundaries over? It's hell for anybody who has tried to do this.
So from the get-go, the code that you write in Qwik is going to be able to be chopped up and lazy loaded as you need it and prefetched and all of that good stuff.
Yeah. So the one way to think about it is that we basically place lazy loaded boundaries everywhere, like everywhere we could possibly think of, right? Between components, listeners, use effect functions, use init functions, like every single thing you could possibly think of that could be delayed loaded, it automatically gets a lazy loader boundary. And what I mean by that is you as a developer don't have to think about it, right? You don't have to like put the code in a separate file. You don't have to create a lazy wrapper around it. You don't have to put a dynamic import. You don't have to worry about how to lazy load this thing. Like all of these things that come with lazy loading are not your problem. You don't even have to think about it. And you don't even have to think about it, like, is this a good idea whether or not you should place a lazy load boundary here?
Oh, I was just going to say, I love that because we saw this with images 3 or 4 years ago because everybody was saying, resize your images, generate multiple versions, source set, lazy load, all that stuff. And nobody, like some of the big websites with big engineering teams is, but the regular developers didn't do it because they don't have time for that. And it only started happening when it just got baked into the framework and you just use the image tag and the framework does it all for you. It resizes them all for you. And I've been saying that for a while with a lot of performance stuff is it's not going to get better until the tool does it for you.
Yeah, do it for me. Yeah, totally.
Absolutely, absolutely. So here I'm going to do a little jump off point here. And, you know, we kind of talked about how like everything is lazy loadable. Mm-hmm. And now I'm going to want to show you how it is hard for existing frameworks to do that. Because the thing that happens when you first come to a page is we have something called a hydration, right? And, you know, we can get into the weeds of hydration, but basically how hydration works is you start with a root component and you recursively go through all of the child components. And as you recursively go through all the components, you're looking for the listeners as well as the state that's associated with each component. And also you're looking for what are the component boundaries, right? The framework needs this information in order to run. But notice what's happening. If you have lazy loading and if you put a lazy loaded boundary everywhere, then the hydration just basically loads everything. Do you see that? Do you see how like hydration like starts with the root and it's just like, well, I need the root component. Well, now I need the children. And now I need da, 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 right? And so like you did all this work to break the system up and hydration is like, yeah, nice, but I need it all. So give it back.
Let me do it twice. And not only that, but if there's some difference between the server side and the client side version, there could be a mismatch there. That's like a frequent issue people have when they first start getting into React, right? Now all of a sudden React's throwing some kind of error that is, this is expecting a div, but it received a div. And you're like, well, okay, that, look, what is this? It's because when it's trying to hydrate, it can't connect the two because they're different and the environments are different that are rendering the two. So you mentioned already once that in Quick has server-side rendering out of the box. Is that like a Quick City thing? Is that something you get with Quick City or is that something you get with Quick?
It's actually Quick that does this. Like one of the things that I talk about is how most frameworks basically say, my job is to do rendering. And they kind of leave everything else to the Meta framework. The problem is, if you want to really get good at SSR, or you want to get really good at lazy loading, or breaking components up, or you know all of these fancy things, the framework kind of needs to be in the business of it. Like it has to understand, like, oh, there's an asynchronous boundary here, and therefore I have to do lazy loading. Or I have to worry about how to prefetch this particular data so that when the user interacts, it's not slow. And so unless the framework really worries about all of these things, doing it later on the Meta framework level is actually much more difficult and oftentimes impossible. One of the things, for example, we do is when you say, you know, let's say you have a click listener, and this click listener needs to get lazy loaded, right? So the dynamic import requires that the lazy loading is in a separate file. And so we need to basically take that piece of code and move it to a separate location. That happens automatically by it. This kind of messes things up for the bundler. So the bundler has to understand like, oh, this thing just got moved. It's not here. But the runtime also has to be notified saying like, oh, this function that I used to give you that used to be synchronous is now asynchronous. And so by me moving it to a separate file, I've actually broken the system semantically. It's not the same equivalent thing. And you see today bundlers, they can only move things around as long as it's semantically equivalent. And so by being allowed to do things that are semantically not equivalent, the bundler, so to speak, has more freedom, but the runtime has to be like, I'm cool with this. Like, I'm not going to throw a fit if you do this. So you need to have this collaboration that simply doesn't exist in other frameworks.
Yeah, you got to go all in. So as much as it is a client-side framework, it's also a server framework that does it, right?
That's right.
You got buy in on both sides.
It is the responsibility of it.
In Node?
It runs in any JavaScript environment. So ooh, not specifically Node. So we don't require like require or any kind of Node APIs so that we can run on Edge as well. So Node, Dino, Edge workers, you know, the gamut. So we only do standard JavaScript APIs, fetch and so on, so that it can run in any JavaScript environment, not just Node.
Nice. And this whole system, is this Vite based or what is the backbone of this?
So nice. Yeah, let's talk about how it works. So Vite is amazing. We use Vite for kind of all the heavy lifting. The magical part out of the whole thing is a tool we call Optimizer. And Optimizer is actually written in Rust, so it's super fast. And the job of Optimizer is to move pieces of code into separate files so that we can do the bundling, right? And so the question then becomes, well, how does the tool know to move a piece of code? And the way we do that is we have a very simple heuristic, which is that if you make a function call that ends in a dollar sign, then the first argument should be moved into a separate file. And that means that users can make their own API, right? It's not hard-coded for our special APIs. Like the developer can make their own API. And that simple rule, that this basically dollar sign is a hint to both the optimizer, meaning, do this operation here, but also to the developer that basically says, hey, magic happens here. You know, special rules apply. Not every single JavaScript code that is valid JavaScript code can actually be placed over here, right? So it's both a kind of notification, you know, just like a use method has special rules. You can't just put anything there or any, you know, can't put it inside if statement, et cetera. These dollar signs also have special rules that basically says you can't do certain things over here. And we have a linter to basically to tell you when you are kind of not following the rules. But that's it. You know, as long as you learn these rules, and the rules are pretty straightforward, then, you know, we can move code around. And by moving the code around, we can create lots and lots of entry points. And once we have the entry points, we just feed it to the standard bundling system. You know, so either Vite does it, or we do a roll-up after, you know, if you do a production build. In theory, you could do Webpack, but we don't support it right now. So we just, basically, the optimizer is the piece of code that breaks everything up. And putting it back together is the easy part, right? It's the breaking things apart that's the hard part.
So that dollar sign will fix any issues around like scoping and closures and stuff. Is that what I'm getting at?
Yes. So the dollar sign basically says, move this code out. And so typically, the first argument is a closure. So imagine you have something like a counter and you have an on-click listener. And the on-click listener has to get moved out. The thing is, typically, the on-click listener will capture, you know, lexically, because it's a closure, lexically captures variables. And one variable that you typically capture is a state, so that you can go and increment the state, right? Or, you know, set the state to a new thing. If it's a counter, it basically becomes something equivalent to set state plus one, right? Previous state plus one or something of like that.
Yeah.
And so now you need to capture both the current state and you also need to capture the previous state. And so together, those two things need to be somehow serialized, because when I move the function over the closure over to a separate file, it no longer lexically captures these things. And so one way to think about it is what we as developers know how to do is we know how to serialize state. That's easy. That's JSON.
Yeah.
And we also know how to serialize functions. Well, that's easy. That's just JavaScript. We can lazy load that, right? The thing that Quick lets you do is to serialize closures. It, you know, it serializes on a server a closure that has a particular state with, you know, whatever the counter happens to be, and also a reference to another function, which is the set count equivalent, right? And it serializes in such a way that when you get to the client, the system knows like, oh, I need to grab the state from this JSON and I need to lazy load this code, put it together, merge it, and do some magic. So when I hand you back a function, that function acts as if it had a lexically scoped, captured everything in the system.
That was the one thing that was like really wild. And immediately my mind went to like, could you drop something off on your desktop and then pick it up on your phone and you'd be in the exact same state? Or is there some sort of like, yeah, I know this is probably not the use for it, but like a real time, like two people could be watching the same website at the exact same time. Like you could be streaming those things. And I know it's not what it's meant for, but it seems cool that you can encapsulate literally everything.
Yeah, so that's kind of the magic of it all. I do want to kind of go back a little bit, if you don't mind, and mention a little bit about hydration. And I think this is an important bit. So let's say you've gone through all this trouble where you can lazy load every single component, every single listener, every single use client effect function, right? So now you'd be like, great, I can lazy load all these things. My application have a super fast startup performance. But notice what happens in the hydration. Hydration goes from the root and traverses everything, right? And it forces you to load all of the components. So even though you went through all this trouble of lazy loading everything, hydration kind of does all of this work. And so that's first problem. So you need a way of kind of saying like, I need to not force loading of everything eagerly. That's my first problem. But there's a second problem. And the second problem is, imagine you are like an Amazon product page where there's an item that you want to purchase, right? There's a purchase button. There's a button that says add item to cart. Let's for a second imagine that somehow we skip the hydration. Wave magic hands. Let's not worry about how this is done, right? Now we are at the page where there's the buy button, and I click the buy button, which means I'm going to mutate some state of the system. The way most frameworks solve this particular problem is that the state is somewhere up the tree that is common to both the set, the button, right, add to shopping cart, and it's also common to the shopping cart itself. And if you look at most pages, that means that state is going to be pretty high up the tree. What that means is when you click that button, you go high up the tree and you change the state, and now you're going to go and visit every single child, until you get to the set state and update the shopping cart, right? So the clicking of this thing pretty much just forces you to download most of the application right there.
Oh, yeah.
Do you see that?
Okay. Yeah.
So for that part, in order for this to not happen, Quick has to be fine-grained reactive. Meaning Quick has to basically do this. When you go and modify the state of the buy button, right? So if you click the buy button, it has to be like, oh, you want the state associated with the buy button. Here it is. And now when you modify it, Quick has to be like, oh, I know that the value of this buy button is tied to the shopping cart. And so I can go directly to the shopping cart. I can bypass all of the parent components and common parents and all that stuff, bypass everything and go directly to the shopping cart and be like, I need to update you, right? And then just re-render the shopping cart and nothing else. And not just render the shopping cart, but also, you know, shopping cart might have child components. And so we have to be intelligent enough about not descending into the child components if it's not necessary.
Oh, so it knows exactly. It kind of goes up and then says, all right, well, I got this new state. Which of you need it? And you know which ones to update?
Okay. Yes. So this is the hard part. The system knows how to answer this question before any of your application code is loaded. And that's the magical bit. Because we can answer this question before the application code is loaded, we can delay loading vast majority of the application code forever. And I say forever because many components are what we call dumb components, meaning that they, once they're rendered or initially on the page, they never re-render again. And because they never re-render again, you never have to download them again because, like, why would you download them if they never re-render?
And that encapsulates so many, like, I think so many of the big problems with modern JS frameworks as they are, it's doing too much when they don't need to be doing anything, right? And
that's right.
I think that really feels like Quick's biggest strength is that it does only what it needs to do. It's, you know, you think about like jQuery being back to, you write a specific jQuery function that does one thing the only time you tell it to do it, and that's all it does, right?
Yeah, but like our motivation for doing this is not necessarily to be like fast. Our motivation is so we don't have to download all this code, right? That's the motivation. Like if you don't have to download all this code, then like you can do all kinds of tricks like that. You know, one common thing to do in React is to say, use memo. Like, oh, you don't want to descend to a tree? Like, use memo, right?
Yeah.
We don't have use memo because, like, it's just out of the box. Everything is memoized.
We did a show. Did we do it already? We have a show called Do It For Me, which is like, why do I need to go in there and figure these things out? Like, I'm not some performance nut that knows exactly where to put these things, and it would be nice to figure it out.
Performance
nut. All that figuring out, that happens at compile time? Like that's part of the build where it figures it out?
Both.
Okay.
So part of it is compile time and part of it is runtime. So one of the things you can do with Quick, and I think this is super cool and I'm not aware of anybody else doing this, is that initially Quick doesn't really know what are the ideal bundles and what things are needed together. You know, it can break everything up and, you know, it's just doesn't know this information just yet. But what you can do is you can build your initial application with like a bunch of heuristics, and then you can feed the application to your users. Let them play with it. Let them use it, interact with it, you know, et cetera. And as they're using it, you get to collect statistical information about like how are they actually using it, which things they need first, which things always need to be downloaded together, and which things are pretty much never downloaded, and which things are actually never downloaded. Like there is no code path that the user can possibly take that will cause you to download this particular component because this component is probably a static component and it rendered on a server, and as a result, it never ever has to render ever on a client, right? So you can collect the statistical information and you can feed that information back to the bundler. So when you do your next revision of your application, now the next revision has like idealized bundle sizes. Because it knows like, oh, this thing, like there is a code path where you can get to it, but I know that the user either never does or does it very rarely, so I'm going to put it at the bottom. Or there's a code path that, you know, the users do, the first thing they do, like the buy button, that's what everybody clicks on, right? So I want to make sure that that thing is above in my bundle sizes. And all of this information then gets fed into our prefetcher. And so the prefetcher then knows how to download these things in the correct order. And of course, again, I'm going to say like, as a developer, you don't have to do anything. And another way to think about it is right now, if you wanted to change your bundling strategy, that is a change to your source code, In Quick, if you want to change the way you generate bundles, that's a configuration information.
Okay.
That's not a change of the source code. Like, it's a configuration information.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's super powerful because it means that as a developer, like, I don't have to refactor my code base. Like, I just written it always the same way. And then there's some other person whose job it is to optimize this thing. And they basically just change configuration information that, like, moves things around, et cetera. And the bundling system produces either more bundles, fewer bundles, you know, moves chunks around, moves functions around. All of those things can be done as a configuration thing, and it doesn't require any changes to the source code. Because, frankly, like, as a developer, when you're building a feature, you have no clue whether you need to lazy load or not, or things go together. Like, it's at best an educated guess, and we're usually wrong on that.
Yeah, yeah. And that's why we, back in the day, we used to just load everything on every single page. We kind of still do that now, but it's a little bit better. I'm thinking back in the day to, like, jQuery apps where you would load every single dependency in order. Don't mess up the order because that's important as well on
and all
literally
of
every single
on
page. And then as you started to get into that, what a nightmare. And this is just like the total opposite of that type of thing. So how does the server collect the information? Like, do you get like a JSON file kicked out the other end? Is there a service?
As of right now, the collection information you would have to implement yourself. So we would post JSON information to you saying like this thing got loaded, this thing got loaded, this thing got loaded, and then you have to aggregate it. We are planning on having a service for you so that you don't have to use it. But, you know, and it's going to be free, so I'm not going to charge for anything. But basically a service that will collect this for you, and then it will tell you what the ideal configuration file is for your bundling system.
Okay.
And to make that work, I mean, one of the things we have to make sure is that the symbol hash codes are stable across builds, right? So there's two things. There is the hashes inside of your chunks, those you don't want to be stable, right? Because you want to make sure that you can cache them forever and that they change, et cetera. So those, you know, change on every single build. But the function names themselves, you want those to be stable so that you can reason about the system.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
You can reference it every single time. Let's talk about state and store a little bit more. So I was looking at the docs. You have stores and signals. So the question is, like, what's the difference between the two? And how do you share state between components that, when you need it? Because I know right now a lot of times people either they put it in a high level in their application, they drop it all the way down as they need it, or they use some sort of other library that can share data between the two.
Same exact way. You can just put it to the top root. I mean, that's kind of the beauty of Quick is that you do the same thing, but we skip all the unnecessary stuff in between, right? That is the thing that we kind of talked about. If you move state somewhere high up, it causes re-rendering of all the children. So mentally, you're like, you do the same thing. You put the state somewhere up, but we're just smart enough to be like, yeah, but we don't need these, the intermediary components do not read the value or do not mutate the value or whatever, right? And so we can look at it and be like, yeah, you actually don't need this.
So putting your provider higher up doesn't negatively affect performance.
Correct. Cool. Correct. Correct.
That's beautiful. Because that's honestly what everybody wants to do. It's so easy.
You have your whole application, the provider. Yeah.
In SvelteLand, you just you import the data and you have access to it. Like, I don't want to have to think about that type of thing. Like, figure it out for me, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So let me actually talk about, this is a little of a tangent, but one of the cool things we can do is imagine you have a provider that, or, you know, you put a state somewhere up in the root of the tree, right? And then you pass it across, et cetera. And then let's say the system kind of, and you need it for rendering it. And let's say it is static, meaning that there is no button to edit or modify, et cetera. So you're purely just providing information to the user and there's no editing capabilities for the user, which is a pretty common use case, right? In Quick, we can actually notice that like, oh, there was a state created, the state got passed down, but there isn't the code path that can possibly modify the state. There is no listener, click listener, or anything. There's no code path that actually modifies the state. And because there's no code path that modifies the state, we don't need to send that state to the client. Like, it just doesn't get sent.
Mm.
So you know the double sending problem where you like send the same information twice, once in the HTML and once as JSON? not always, but in many cases, Quick doesn't have this problem where it just be like, oh, yeah, but no, in this case, we don't need to send it twice. And it just removes it.
And data fetching, like let's say you need to hit your API for some data. Does that initial data fetch happen on the server? And then if you hit a refresh or something, like does that happen on the client? Or does that happen again on the server and they send the HTML over? How does that look?
Yeah. So when you use Quick City has two methods we call loaders and actions. You can think of the loader as getting data to the client, and you can think of action as getting data from the client to the server, right? And loaders, you can have as many as you want. You put them all over your application. Now, the thing that happens with loaders is they are the first thing that executes. If you think about it, if you want to do an SSR and you want to do streaming and you want to be fast, you want to make sure that you kick off the loader as soon as the request comes in. You don't want to be in a situation where you're like, start rendering your application and halfway down the rendering, you're like, oh, this component needs some data and I need to go fetch it, right? Like that's a
time
bad
to get the data.
Because like that means you wasted all this time when you could have been parallelizing it and you could have been fetching the data. So these loaders are kicked off immediately as soon as the request comes in. And these loaders can return, first of all, everything's asynchronous, so they obviously return a promise of your data. Yeah. But they can return either a promise or a function that returns the promise. If they return a promise directly, then we will make sure we will wait for the data to be resolved before we start rendering your application. But if we return a function that is a promise, then we know that like, oh, we can start rendering the application even before that promise is resolved. And now we can have out-of-order streaming, meaning that you can start rendering your application, and at some point the application says, I need the data. And what we hand in to the application is instead of handing the data directly, which is already resolved, we hand in what's equivalent of like a promise to the thing. And we don't have this implemented just yet, but it's on a roadmap, is that we want to be able to then continue rendering past this point. And when the promise resolves, go back and update the UI with the resolved promise. So that if you have a particular loader that you know is slow for whatever reason, you can render everything else on a page and then come back to that particular piece later on.
Okay. And you would come back to that, like would the server sit around and wait for that to come?
So,
or as okay, before it eventually ships to the client?
Yeah. So the whole thing is a single HTTP request. Yeah. And so we would just leave the HTML, so we would like, you know, close the body tag, but then don't close the HTML tag. We would wait over there. And as these promises get resolved, we would insert dynamic script tags that basically say, this is the missing data that you wanted. And also, by the way, this is the inner HTML for the data. So that when, you know, you don't even have to wake up any framework on a client. We literally just patch the HTML in the correct locations.
Okay. Okay. I'm curious your thoughts on JSX. It seems like a lot of frameworks are just using JSX. And is that because you hope to make the transition over for React devs? Or is that because you think JSX is the best templating language out there?
Yes, I'm sure this is going to be polarizing. Okay, let's talk about JSX.
Well, for the guy who created Angular, I just want an if statement, you know?
That's right. That's right. I just want an if statement. Yeah. So JSX is the thing that I like about JSX is that it's very simple in terms of like, it's easy to explain, right? So there's have a certain level of simplicity going for this. And there's a lot of value in having something that is simple, right? And it's easy to learn, easy to teach, easy to reason about. So JSX has that, and it's an important thing, and it shouldn't be underestimated. So in that sense, I think JSX is great. The other thing that JSX has going for it is the tooling support, right? If I make a new templating language, then I have to make a new editor plugin. I have to make new prettifier, you know, linter, and all of these different things that I just don't want to do. So, you know, yes, you could argue that, you know, Svelte or Angular or whatever have a much better, a much more succinct syntax. And I kind of agree they do. It's a better syntax. But there is a cost to it, which, you know, when we were working on Quick, we were just not willing to pay for it. So instead, we just said, you know, let's just take JSX. I think what I would like to see JSX do is there's kind of two things that I think are missing out of JSX. One is ability to kind of tell JSX, like, by the way, this thing is a constant. Like, JSX can't tell the difference when it gets a property. Like, was this bound to a string? Or was this bound to an expression that produced a string? You can't tell the difference at runtime, right? So that's one thing that would be nice. And the other thing that would be nice is that I would love, this is going to be hard to wrap your head around. I apologize. JSX is an expression, right? It returns a value that you can return or pass around or modify, et cetera. And the reason why it's an expression is because React was predominantly VDOM based, right? So for VDOM world, JSX or having a JSX that produces a value makes total sense. But if you want to do something like, for example, SolidJS does, where the JSX is not a value, but rather it's a side effect, it would be much, much nicer if the JSX would be a statement. And if it's a statement, you can put statements inside of if statements, inside of for loops, et cetera, right? So in my opinion, it would be much, much nicer if JSX was a statement rather than an expression.
Ah.
And because it's a statement, you can put an if statement around it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah, it's so funny. I'm so glad you answered that because my very next question is like, what would you want to see out of JSX?
Yeah, that's what I want.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, I love it because it does feel like, you know, JSX exists as this thing and it has existed as this thing, but it hasn't really changed or evolved in any sort of way for so long. And not that it needs to, it works as it does, but, you know, it would be interesting to see what a future of JSX would look like, you know?
I wanted a statement. That's what I want, a statement.
One of my favorite things from the docs that I saw, I was like, thank you, is this is just like a, I don't know what you call it, a directive or a like a attribute to in JSX, which is prevent default colon the event name, click. And I was like, I want that. If I want to prevent default on an event, I don't want to have to write a little event handler. Just let me have an attribute on the tag.
We have to have that because all of our listeners are asynchronous. And so if you want to prevent default, you have to declaratively tell the system like this has to happen.
Wow.
Okay. So we've been talking a lot about like the strengths of Qwik. And I think that's great. I don't want to just be like, what are the weaknesses? But what do you think are the biggest challenges for Qwik as a system moving forward?
Mm-hmm.
Is it adoption or those types of things? Like, what are your biggest challenges?
So I want to break this down into two separate things. I think there are intrinsic challenges and extrinsic challenges. What I mean by that is intrinsic is like it's fundamentally built into the framework and it will never change. And extrinsic meaning that like as of right now, externally, it's difficult because, but it could change in the future, right? So extrinsic challenges is, well, it's new kid on a block, and so the ecosystem isn't there. And oh, by the way, sorry, I'm going to go on a tangent here. Oh, by the way, we have this thing called Qwik React. We can take React components, run them through a function called Qwikify, and then include them in a Qwik application.
Oh my gosh.
And what that will do is that it will take your React component and will automatically turn it into a lazy loadable component. It can delay hydration for that component. Obviously, the magic inside, we can't do magic inside of the React, right? So the React component will do what it has always done. But it gets wrapped together inside of basically an island so that we can delay hydrate it. We can maybe not hydrate it at all. This all works with SSR and so on. So if you have your material design components library that you want to use inside of your Qwik application,
mm-hmm.
you can do that. You can do it with Qwik React. Or if you want to have an existing React application and you want to migrate it to Qwik and you don't want to do it all in one shot, we have basically this bridge that's available for you. So very proud of it. And I think your listeners are primarily React, so they should find this interesting.
That's amazing. I was just going to ask that, like, what's the answer to us? Like, we shouldn't be making React dropdown and React multi-select and then like a Svelte dropdown and Svelte multi-select. Like, what's the answer there? How should we make a component that, or can we even make components that we can use in all the frameworks? What
yes,
do you think about that?
It's called mitosis. So a separate project that we have is a project called mitosis. and what mitosis does is it basically allows you to declare the component in, guess what, yet another syntax. But the nice thing about it is it can translate that syntax into the other syntaxes of the other frameworks. Now, this isn't a wrapper. This isn't like taking a web component and wrapping it in some thin shell to make it a React component. No, no. We generate code. When you look at the outputted code, it's literally React code, or it's literally Quick code, or it is Lit code, or web component, or whatever your favorite framework insert here is. And so with Mitosis, you can, and we have a lot of actually customers who use Mitosis for their design systems so that they implement the design system once in Mitosis and then, you know, spit out whatever framework they, I mean, whatever different flavors of it they have. And then they can give it to, you know, there's a subteam that uses Angular. Like, here's an Angular generated code, right? It's not like a wrapper or something. It's literally Angular code. Right. And at some point, if you don't like Mitosis, you think Mitosis is junk, just take your generated code and commit it into your repository, because it's literally what a human would have written had you had a human write this thing.
Wow. That's so cool. Because I was talking to a friend the other day. He works at a bank. They have 5,000 developers and 30 different teams. They all work on their own product. And that's unfortunately just the how large corporations work.
That's right.
And like a design system, or even like a shared component for a specific internal component shared across all the frameworks. So like, would you do your own state and everything inside of Mitosis?
Yeah, you could do all that stuff.
Wow, that's great. Man, so you've got everything.
We have this because, so let's talk about Builder for a second. Builder is a CMS system. And CMS system roughly basically divide into headless and hosted. Hosted would be something like Wix, right? So a headless would be like, I write my own application in React, Quick, whatever your framework happens to be. And my marketing is constantly bugging me to go and update the homepage, right? And so a lot of times people integrate a CMS system into a headless CMS system into it. Except there is like a bajillion headless CMS systems to choose from. They're all essentially the same thing. So the thing you realize with headless systems very quickly is like, oh, the marketing can change the URL for the image, but now they want to have two images. Well, guess what? An engineer has to be involved to do all of this work, right? Yeah. And so while it's an improvement, it doesn't actually solve the thing. And so what Builder is what we call a visual CMS system. And what it means is that we give you a component. You literally NPM install a component and you drop it into your application. So you, let's say you have a React application, you install builder/SDK-React into your thing, and you take this component, you drop it wherever you want, and that component now does two things. It does both rendering for the user, but it also becomes a drag and drop editor for your marketing people. And within that component, the marketing people can like do whatever they want. Like, they can add multiple columns, they can add multiple images, change the text, you know, make the second word a letter of the first word blue, like whatever.
Yeah.
Do whatever
the stuff
you want.
That marketing people want to do. Yeah.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah.
And so we call it visual. And the thing that's different about it is that we can't just give you JSON. We have to give you components. And because we have to give you components, we have to give you the component in the framework of your choice. Right? So we have to give you a component for every single framework out there. And that would be unreasonable for us to do this manually. And so we have Mitosis to solve this problem for us.
Oh, man. That's great. I've been thinking about this a lot lately. I've been seeing it pop up as this like happy medium of like totally custom built, and then maybe give the marketing people their own website that they can update like with the drag and drop. And then you have like your product and your marketing is separate, or like, and or you go totally like some drag and drop builder, but then the developer has no control and they're stuck editing a text box in the browser, you know? So this is like a happy medium. So this is builder.io for everyone. You can plug it. This is your company, right? This is what you're building this all.
You can think of it as take Wix and embed it into your application. That's literally what builder.io is.
Wow.
And Wes, you might not know this, but we have Steve from Builder.
Yeah.
.io
coming on
as
well.
Awesome.
So we can get a whole hour into builder.io, which I'm super excited about after getting this little taste of here.
Whatever you're doing at builder.io, but it's all I see on my Twitter feed recently.
Good.
So
yeah.
Working as intended.
Yeah, yeah. Well, if you build literally every single tool under the sun, I guess we'll pay attention.
So we haven't talked about one more tool, which is PartyTown.
Yes, so, yes.
That's what I was going to ask about.
Next on the list.
We've mentioned that a few times on the podcast. Tell us what that is.
So let's back up a second and let's talk about like the goals that we want as a developers, right? As a developers, we want to have a beautiful developer experience to build websites easily. What the user wants is user wants a fast application primarily, right? And then nice interactivity, et cetera, that the developer has to give them. But primarily, they want a very nice fast interaction. Like I don't want to come to, I'm in a Twitter and I see an ad for like awesome shoes and I'm like, I have to have these shoes, right? They're going to make me jump higher. So you click on the button and you're like, okay, I love it. I'm ready to buy. I push the buy button and nothing happens. And now I wait. And like at some point, your lizard brain gets overwritten by your rational brain and says, this is marketing stuff. You don't need to click on this thing, right? And if you wait long enough, this is, you know, I don't need to buy this. And so you lose a sale, right? And so you want to have a fast UI because money is either made or lost if your application is slow. So what the users want is the fastest possible website. Now, if you dig into this and go through like what makes a fast site fast, and if you, you know, spend hours and months on everything, your fundamental realization is going to be it's simple. Send less JavaScript. It is so simple and obvious and yet so hard to kind of grok. You want the site faster? Send less JavaScript. Yeah. It is that simple, right? So Builder has a lot of customers that have the same problem, not because of Builder, but because like, you know, you build React or Quick or whatever, and like if the website is big and slow and clunky, like how do we make it faster, right? And so Builder is in the business of solving this thing for our customers, and we do it in an open source way. And there's two places where your JavaScript comes from. It comes from your first party code, the code you have written, and there the answer is Quick. And it also comes from a third party code, which is the code that you're embedding on your website. And there the answer is PartyTown. So I just did a blog post on this thing, and I think it's very telling, is that I had a blank page, nothing on it. And I embedded Twitter tweet, which is a common thing people put on their homepage, like, oh, look what other people are saying about this, you know, social proof. So I embedded a single tweet into this blank, otherwise white page, and I gave it to Google PageSpeed score as to like, what am I going to get out of this thing? I forget the exact numbers, but Google basically says, your page scores 70 out of 100. Just let that sink in, like a blank tweet. A single one. So then I embedded four tweets. Then I embedded four tweets and it fell down to like, I think 39 or something.
Oh my gosh.
Right? So like, this is insanity that third-party code destroys your performance. And so what we do with PartyTown is we allow you to take the third-party code and run it in a web worker. And there's a complicated set of hacks that you have to do in order to do that because, you know, we can go into the weeds if you want. But fundamentally, what it does is it runs in a web worker. And by running in a web worker, the code actually runs slower. Like, you can't make it run faster. And like, the code inside of the web worker is slower because it has to go back and forth and marshaling all kinds of stuff. But because most of the things we do for third-party code is like analytics or HubSpot or something like that, like who cares if the code reports this thing now or 100 milliseconds later, right? It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Right?
Totally.
And so even though it runs slower, the end result is that the UX for the user is much, much improved because they don't have to wait for all of that code to execute before they run. A modern phone has multiple cores inside of its CPU, right?
Yeah.
But JavaScript is single-threaded. So it doesn't matter how many cores you have. You only get to use one. With web workers, you get to use multiple cores on your CPU because we're moving it to a separate thread. And so that's kind of the magic of PartyTown, is that it kind of brings multitasking into your application.
That's awesome.
And can I just say, too, I think one of the coolest things about PartyTown, besides the fact of it existing, is that
his name?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that as well. Yeah. Is that you have docs on how to get this up and running with so many popular things. Like, you didn't build this just for your own thing and say, hey, if you want this extra juice, you got to come to our framework. And that there's docs on how to get this up and running with Astro, Angular, Next, Nux, Remix, Remix, Shopify, SvelteKit, like anything you want. It's amazing.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Wow. So that's incredible. Yeah. Very incredible. Wes, do you want to take this into the supper club questions or do we have anything else? Yeah.
To wrap it up, we'll ask you a couple questions that we ask every single guest that we have on the podcast. First one here.
Oh, this is where it gets hard. Okay.
Yeah. The first one is, which computer and keyboard do you use?
Ah, okay. I have one of the first Apple M1 Macs.
Yeah.
The first one, as soon as they came out. So like at this point, it's a little old, but I love it. The battery life is amazing. It works great for me, so I'm keeping it for now. I have an external monitor to go with it. I have a Kinesis keyboard, one of those, the ones that are broken in half.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right? Because like, I, you know, like you don't want to type like this where your hands are coming together. You want to, so much more comfortable to kind
of I think I need to get one of these.
Angle the wrists into parts. The keyboard is nothing special. It's just a regular keyboard. It's not like a fancy. Now, people go crazy with their keyboards. This is just a cheapo Bluetooth Kinesis keyboard. But what's crazy about it is I typed Dvorak. I am one of those crazy people.
That How long have you been doing that for?
Long time. Over 10 years, I think. Maybe even longer. I wouldn't recommend it to anybody because once I switched, it took me like... For 2 years, I couldn't type. It was horrible.
One time I made the wrong decision of switching my phone to Dvorak because it was easy to do that. You know, you have your laptop, you can't just switch it. So I switched my phone thinking like, I'll learn it on this. But in turn, it just made me unable to type anything at any given point.
You know what? Dvorak is actually horrible for phones.
I believe.
Because you know how a lot of people swipe? The problem is Dvorak puts the keys that are commonly used letters next to each other. What that means that the swiping can't work because it's like, well, like all of these are prediction of what you could do next and they're all in the same vicinity. Like, I don't know. Right? The swipe,
that's hilarious.
Swipe works great when the letters are like scattered, right? They're far apart.
So do you use QWERTY on your phone then?
Yeah, I do QWERTY on my phone and I do Dvorak.
Wow.
And what's also interesting is the human brain just switches. Like if I don't look at the keyboard and I use all 10 fingers for typing, I am automatically Dvorak. And then when I start like pecking, like on a phone, I automatically switch to QWERTY without any sort of thought or anything. It's just natural thing to do.
That's wild.
That is wild.
What about your text editor? Do you use anything fancy, or what about theme and font? Text editor, theme and font.
Just VS Code out of the box. Used to be a long time ago. I used to do Java, and so I came from Eclipse background.
Mm-hmm.
I used to be a big Eclipse fan. Then I switched over to WebStorm, and I was a big WebStorm fan. And then I just got tired of begging for free licenses for open source projects from IntelliJ. Forget it. I'll just use VS Code. So I'm just a VS Code user.
What about Terminal and Shell?
I installed this thing called Fig. Have you played with this?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, big Fig user.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it's really good. Big fan of Fig. And have you tried Warp as well?
No, I have not.
Oh, you should definitely check that
actually,
out.
Actually, if you think about it, like I don't really customize my computer that much.
Yeah.
Like it's all vanilla basics. I know people go nuts with what they do. I'm like, simple stuff. Like, you know, if the computer gets lost, I'd have to use another one. I won't even notice because it's the same default setup.
Honestly, there's a correlation on this podcast of, I think the smarter the guest, the less fancy stuff they have hooked up. Whereas it's like me and Scott are spending time decking out our everything and all these configs and everything. And then you get these other people and they're like, oh yeah, I don't use a linter or configs or anything. I don't, whatever comes default with VS Code, that's what I use.
You know, there's always this one person on your team who like has Linux and custom whatever. And like, and the amount of time they spend custom, I'm like, dude, just write code and move on.
I don't
like,
have time for that.
Yeah. And they always have issues. Like it's a Zoom call and they're like, sorry, my driver seems to having issues with my video or my sound. It's like, just use the Mac, you know? Like,
what do you stay up? How do you stay up to date in web technology?
I mean, who says I'm up to date?
Fast moving industry. I think quick kind of says that. It's a very forward thinking. Do you like, I don't know, where do you hunt and learn new things from, I guess?
Yeah, I kind of try to pay attention. I mean, Twitter is kind of the natural place to go. there is lots and lots of smart people that are around me, way smarter than I am, who always have great ideas and, you know, pointing them out. And I tried my best listening, although that's a very difficult skill to do. Quick itself, the interesting thing about Quick is like in 2009, which is now about 3 years, almost 4 years ago, I gave a talk in ngConf and I basically laid out, you know, what a resumable framework should be. And, you know, the crowd, and there's a video of this on YouTube. And the crowd was like, yeah, sounds good. And then, of course, nobody did anything for years. Like, I just told you how to do this. Like, why doesn't somebody do this thing? Yeah. And so I was kind of searching and I was like, I know I wanted to do a career change. I was like, okay, I'm done with Google. It's time for me to move on. I've been there for 16 years. Like, I just needed something new. And I was like, what do I do? And like, and I had many paths in front of me. And one of them was like, Quick. And I was like, the world needs Quick. But I'm like, I don't want to do this. I've already done this many times. Like, I just don't want to do this. But somehow I got sucked down the rabbit hole again. And here I am again. Yet another framework. But resumably, I mean, Quick was actually a little bit also inspired by a framework called Wiz from Google.
Mm.
And Wiz is a framework you never heard of, but use every day. So Wiz runs Google Search, for example. It runs Google Photos and many other products. And one thing you'll notice about Google Search is that it's freaking instant. The moment the content shows up, you can interact with it. There's no delay. And I know a lot of people are going to say like, oh, but it's just a search page. It's easy to build. I'm like, really? Have you searched for a movie? Put in an equation? An address?
Yeah.
Like the stuff that like gets embedded inside of that page is insane. Like if you type in an equation, you get an interactive graph editor, right? It's not just, you have to have this lazy loadable system because you need to, you have all the possible ways that the user can type a query and you have all the possible code that you could possibly send to the client, but then you have to be intelligent enough and I'd say like, well, this query doesn't need that, so I'm not going to send it.
I was always wondering about that, how Google does that. They bring up the currency converter or the thing where it does do a barrel roll and like, I'm like what's the system for? They're obviously not loading that on every single page. It's Wiz.
It's Wiz. So Wiz was kind of my inspiration for Quick. So the CAP theorem for databases? Which basically says you can have two out of the three things, but never all three.
Yes, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know that Google broke the CAP theorem. They installed atomic clocks in their data centers. So they broke the CAP theorems. And I think that's kind of interesting. So I joke that there is a CAP theorem for front-end frameworks. That is, a framework, you want to have three things. You want to have speed for the user, you want to have a developer experience, and you want to have capabilities. Right? And existing frameworks can deliver only two out of the three things. So if you look at like the common frameworks, like Angular, React, Svelte, and so on, they have a great DX, they have great capabilities, but they're kind of slow on startup, right? Which is kind of why we're talking about the stuff here, right? Mm-hmm. So they don't have the performance in terms of startup performance. If you look at frameworks like 11t and Astro, they have a great DX, awesome startup performance, but the capabilities are limiting. Even if you go to Astro's documentation, they'll tell you right there saying like, this is not for everything. There are a certain class of apps that you can build and are perfect for Astro and certain class of apps that are not good for Astro. So don't try to build those things with us, right? So the capabilities are limited. And the thing we're trying to do with Quick is to have all three, a beautiful DX experience, all the capabilities you want, and the performance of Astro if it's a simple app like an Astro app, like it should be no difference, or 11T, but at the same time, be able to build anything you want and still have good performance.
Beautiful, beautiful.
Wow. So we want to break the front-end CAP theorem.
I like it. I'm here for it. That's good. let's move into the last section now, which is shameless plugs sick picks and a shameless plug. I'm not sure did you come prepared with a shameless plug or not, or would you like us to explain that to you?
I did not get prepared. Well, what is a sick pick? I'm afraid.
A sick pick is a product, a piece of software, a chocolate bar, literally anything in your life, code related or not, that you would like to spread to the masses, something that you enjoy so much. It could be a knife or literally anything.
I like a particular book. The book is called, I've read it a long time ago, but this is my favorite book of all times. It's called Thinking Fast and Slow by David Kahneman.
Okay.
And David Kahneman was a psychologist, and you know, he showed up for a psychology lesson the first day in class. Oh no, he was an economist originally, turned into a psychologist. He showed up for an economy lesson in college, and the professor started with like, on average, humans are reasonable, or humans are rational. And he goes like, that's not true. And then he spends his whole life basically showing just how systematically unreasonable humans are, right? So it's not, you can't average us, because we're not like randomly wrong in all the different directions. We're randomly wrong, we're systematically wrong in the same direction. And so the book is really about like all the different ways your brain lies to you in a way that you don't even notice.
Wow.
And I think it should be like a user handbook for your brain. You should read this thing, and you should be like, you know, this is how your brain plays games on you, and you don't even realize it.
Wow. Yeah.
Okay. It's a very, very thick book. He got Nobel Prize for his work, et cetera. So it's definitely a you know, kind of deep read, but it's very well written, and it's easy. It's not like, you know, super scientific or whatever. It's more like layman's term kind of a thing. And the other thing that's kind of interesting about it is that it talks about this thing called System 1 and System 2. And you read about System 1 and you go like, oh, that's a neural net. That is literally what neural nets are. Like, one for one. Like, this is like checks all the boxes. And then he says humans have this thing called System 2, which is nothing like neural nets. It's something completely different. The closest thing we have is like Wolfram Alpha. You know that project by... Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like a symbolic manipulator kind of a thing that does things differently. And we have nothing on that. And you need both. You need System 1 and you need System 2 in order to have intelligence or whatever. And, you know, we're kind of missing a big part of the whole thing.
Yeah.
Anyways, I went down the rabbit hole on this thing. But that's my favorite book of all time.
That's good. That's a sick pick. That's a bona fide sick pick. I like it. All right. Last thing is...
I already clicked download.
Last thing is shameless plugs. I know you've been plugging stuff all thing, but give us your plugs before you head off.
I have to go for a builder. You know, it's the thing that pays our bills. Headless visual CMS is what we are. Basically, you NPM install a component into your existing application, and that component, you know, becomes an editor, so you can hand it over to marketing. And the component, you know, is just a box on your page, and you can make the box as big or as small. You can give your marketing team as much control as you want or as little control as you want. And it is, in my opinion, the way to do a CMS system.
Beautiful. Check it out, builder.io. Yeah. We'll link it up in the show notes as well. Thank you so much for coming on. Really appreciate all your time and insights. That was fantastic.
Thank you for having me. This was so much fun.
Yeah.
You're welcome. All right. Thanks again. See you later.
See you.
Head on over to syntax.fm for a full archive of all of our shows. And don't forget to subscribe in your podcast player or drop a review if you like this show.